There's a visibility element to multi-platform storytelling. It used to be that the value was in scarcity, exclusivity on one platform. That doesn't work anymore because attention is what's scarce now. That's what you have to trade in.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly and I'm delighted to bring you the latest in a series of conversations with journalists and authors, broadcasters, filmmakers, executives, innovative creators and campaigners about the changing relationship between sport and the storytelling and communities that build around it. Good to be back with you, and we're going to be returning, as discussed a couple of episodes ago, to the topic of sport and younger audiences. And I think, as we'll cover today, it's an important area to try and grapple with because it really hints at what the future of all sports media might look like. Our guest is Joe Redfern, the founder of Futurehead Media and a specialist in digital media strategy. Joe was previously the head of brand at BBC Children's and Education, where she not only helped drive the corporation's commercial strategy in that sector, but she also got an insight into how the creators of children's programming were thinking about their audiences and how families were interacting with their favourite shows across multiple settings. She's now gone on to advise sports bodies, including the Premier League and the RNA, about how they should approach those digital platforms. And that's how we're going to frame the conversation on this podcast, talking primarily and in turn about YouTube, TikTok, and gaming spaces like Roblox. Joe explains how the audience dynamics differ across those platforms and why it's crucial to think about need states and appropriate storytelling modes for each one. And she also talks about the creator mindset, the unexplored power of animation, and what sport can learn from Bluey on and off the screen. Some fascinating stuff ahead. Couple of brief notes before we start. Now, the first few episodes have come out in a bit of a burst, but now we're up and running, we'll be settling into a nice weekly schedule from here on in. So keep an eye and an ear out for new episodes each Wednesday after this one. Outlines now also has its official social media accounts live as well. So you'll be able to find clips on Instagram and TikTok, and we're also on Blue Sky and Threads. It's going to be pretty key to getting a community going around the series, so do take a look at the show notes for the details. Right, that's that done. Here is Joe Redfern. I think this week, you talk about kids media a bit. I think I've heard you on the radio talking about Netflix and TF1 and... You know, you seem to pop up in all sorts of different places.
Yeah. And do you know what? I guess that kind of belies my career to date. So I'm relatively new into the world of sport and the sports industry. Been about 12 months since I decided to pivot and shift my focus from what had taken up most of the preceding 20 years, really, is working in that world of kids media, originally in broadcast, creating and supporting IP. So I was there at the launch of Peppa Pig when Peppa Pig was first born, created. And really that was me falling in love with storytelling. But in recent times, having moved away from traditional broadcast, following the audience, that kids' audience, to digital platforms like YouTube, Minecraft, Roblox, I kind of followed them. And what it really showed me in the last 5 years in kids media is that it necessitates a different way of telling stories, a whole different set of competencies driven by your audience, now spending time across all of these platforms, now having unprecedented choice in media and entertainment. And I always used to threaten that if I ever left the world of kids media, I'd go and work in sport because I love sport. I was a gymnast as a kid, got to quite a high level of gymnastics. So I was always sporty, was always upside down. My mom used to joke that I used to spend more time on my hands than my feet. I will watch almost any sport and have sporty kids and a sporty husband. So there was a point when we returned from a 12-month stint in Vancouver about 12 months ago, and I decided, okay, there's a natural break point here to pivot towards sport, having observed that sport as a business and as a media business hadn't really undergone that full transformation yet that I'd seen in kids' media, again, driven by audiences, by young audiences, how they were consuming sport. Again, having two teenage boys, sport mad, seeing how they were fans, how their fandom changed. Well, their fandom was very much driven through Rocket League, Roblox, YouTube Shorts, following creators, Sidemen Sundays. So that really, again, started those thoughts about these different competencies in storytelling. You can still tell stories in sport. Sport is one of the best crucibles for storytelling, but it's a new way of doing it that's less focused on that live product. So yeah, reached out to a few people that I kind of knew in sport, and the rest, as they say, is history. So I've had the privilege of having the Premier League amongst my clients and the Royal and Ancient Golf Club of St. Andrews. And I'm having, well, I have to say, Owen, I'm hooked. I'm hooked on sport. I'm not going anywhere now.
Okay, it's good to hear. What's just on that point of, you know, the sport being maybe a beat behind children's media in the way that it thinks about those audiences. Mm. I mean, what would you ascribe that to? Someone who's coming into the industry in the last couple of years, because people are aware of it, right? But people haven't maybe built the competencies, as you say, to deal with it. Is that a question of something like children's media being first because of the way that it's used and the way that audiences are developed? Mm. Or is it the profit incentive for sport, just the fact that the live bundle was so important for so long from an income perspective?
I think it's a mixture of both, actually, and both of those are really important factors. I think in terms of that, you know, it, even in kids' media, it happened. So that transformation was forced upon the industry, but just with the very nature of kids' consumption, they're already in the future. How they're consuming is almost a bellwether for how the rest of media, whether it's sports media or docs, you know, that kind of content will be consumed. So that, again, necessitated a lot of pivoting. You know, you've got studios and broadcasters like Nickelodeon that were beginning to realize that a vast proportion of their viewership was moving into YouTube. So Nickelodeon recently commissioned, produced, and uploaded their first YouTube-first series designed for YouTube. Completely, you know, a 180 from how Nickelodeon used to be. Same with BBC Studios, not traditionally at the front of the, you know, pushing the envelope. Even BBC Studios with Bluey has a social first, a YouTube strategy, a TikTok strategy. So that, I mean, it's not been without its pain and its, you know, its twinges and its niggles, that transformation for a lot of kids' media storytellers, whether you're a producer or a broadcaster, as I said. But what has come out of the other side of it is these new competencies, this much closer relationship with the audience, the data and the feedback loops that you can put in place on those platforms that enables you to get to know your audience much better than if you were solely reliant on a broadcaster. Getting data out of broadcasters is notoriously hard. So that has grown these new competencies, new distribution methods, and also new ways to monetize. And let's face it, you know, we don't all do this out of the goodness of our hearts. At some point, we've got to make some money with it. So this is the interesting shift. And there are some parallels now in sport. Obviously, it's not quite comparing apples with apples. Sport is a different product. It's a different consumption pattern, a different audience, but they're all equally some similarities. Again, you've got the younger generations now that are social first fans. They're finding the sport, the creator slash athlete, the team that they like, and they're finding it first on those social platforms. They're not finding it first necessarily on TNT or Sky Sports. They might have seen that because their parents are watching it, but this discovery is much more social first and in these digital platforms. That means you've got to think about what their need state is when they're there. Because if they're only on TikTok for quick jokes or skills or a bit of freestyling or a life hack or something, then you've got to think about how you articulate what your sport is about on that platform. You don't just take a clip from the live broadcast and think it's going to work on those platforms. So that's the interesting thing for me as someone who is a natural storyteller is, again, in my head, now I'm thinking, right, what is that strategy for storytelling across all of these platforms that still brings with it the essence of sport and live being part of it? But how do you articulate it for a generation whose need states on these platforms is so very different?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I was having a similar conversation on the podcast with Stuart Rosen, who's got a not dissimilar background to you, ex-BBC, albeit...
I know, Stuart used to work with him.
Yeah, yep. A lot of time in the sports department in his case. But, you know, that difference between discovery in the 90s or the pre-internet age, and even, to be honest, the pre-on-demand age is something people haven't quite got their heads around yet as it relates to audience acquisition in sport. But it also, you know, it's something where there isn't anyone who's gone on that journey who only knows that. There are people who are adults now who grew up with the internet and don't know a world before it. But if you think iPlayer is, what, 2007-ish, Netflix streaming is probably early 2010s for most people. The idea that your whole media diet is on demand or on socials or whatever, as you know, lots of toddlers can attest to that. That's how their media diet is primarily arranged.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't something that anyone younger than 20 or 25 really has much of a sense of. So, I mean, what are we going to start finding out about how that shapes people and you know, what that means in terms of your kind of young audience strategy if you're in sport?
I think the signs are already there if you're looking for them. And you hear them spoken about, you know. Fandom used to be a geographical factor. So it was usually your local team. You either walked to match day or it was something where you had an affiliation that was relatively local. Or it was something that was dictated by your family. So familial, you know, generational thing. We've all kind of read how those things are falling away. They still exist, but they're not the sole means of transmission of fandom or seeding fandom, if you like. So what does that mean? Well, that means that you've got, I mean, these things, she says, holding up her phone for those not watching. The average age of in the UK of a young person getting their first phone is now under 10, according to Ofcom. So basically, under 10, they're getting access to all the world sports, to all the world sports teams and players and creators, so and athletes. So that basically completely removes that geographical and familial driver as being the sole or the primary source of that fandom. So you've got kids who fall in love with PSG or they fall in love with Messi. My youngest fell in love with Andres Iniesta. And and then followed them. Halo fandom sprung up. Dad's a Man United fan, so he still kind of followed that. We live in South Manchester. But started getting his own fandoms. Now he's actually, because of they're in front of the paywall, loves Barcelona women's team. So he's all of these different fandoms. And that really, that's quite hard for an industry whose very structure and DNA is almost built on that geographical and familial way of growing fandom. So really, I think that's a challenge, both in terms of rights, in terms of media consumption, and in terms of commercialization. And that there's going to need to be some kind of pivoting. I think what it also means is less and less that live product is important. It was at the very core, wasn't it? That live product was the whole core. And now that's less important. Younger people will watch a 90-minute game if it's if it's Champions League final or if it's NBA playoffs or NBA finals. But again, they've now got access to so much sport. There isn't time in their lives to watch all of it live. Therefore, they just watch creator or athlete content on TikTok. They do watch highlights. They watch creator content on YouTube. So this whole business model almost will have change forced on it because there will be a reduction in the importance of that live.
Yeah.
And then the whole fandom that surrounds it.
Yeah. And that sort of by extension takes you from an exclusive world where, you know, you're bagging up and selling your rights to one organization who get to make use of them to a multi-platform world. And this is something that you talk about quite a lot. So let's break down each of those platforms and kind of how that works sort of creatively and strategically. And we'll start with YouTube. I mean, what are some of the things that you've learned and also that you try and impart on sports bodies about how YouTube operates as a storytelling platform and you know what the advantages are? Because I think you know that's something that a lot of teams and leagues are on a journey about right now.
What to say about YouTube? I mean, it's hard. There's a big debate that I have frequently amongst other media observers and commentators as to whether YouTube is TV. And it depends how you define TV, what the concept and the notion of TV is. If you think of TV being the first destination for video content, then YouTube is TV for young people. That means it's where they're going to encounter sport. It's also where they're going to encounter creator content, comedy content, UGC content that's quite low quality, but increasingly higher quality content that's being produced by creators who are almost now acting like mini Hollywood studios. You think of The Sidemen, you think of Darman. So they're making content that's quite high quality on there. So that YouTube, super powerful, increasingly consumed not through mobile, on the biggest screen in the house. So that space that used to be owned by TNT or Netflix or even CBeebies, that now is increasingly having its space encroached upon by YouTube because we've all got connected TVs and that YouTube app is there just begging to be opened. So is YouTube TV? Well, it's going onto the TV set, the device. And if TV is what young people go to first for their media and their entertainment, yes, it's also TV for young people. So how does sport deal with that? Okay, well, what YouTube is best at, and there is debate as to how much community it really can create, but I am a believer that you can create community on YouTube. I've seen it plenty of times. You've got this interactivity. You've got the ability to comment. If you're doing a live, you've got the ability to chat and respond to your audience live. Mark Goldbridge does it brilliantly. Someone posts a super chat when he's doing an alt commentary or a watch along, he'll respond to them. There's a big kudos and a reward in that. So this participatory relationship with the media or with your favorite creator or with your favorite sport or team you can have on YouTube is really powerful because we're all about connection, aren't we? We're human at the end of the day. And this parasocial connection YouTube facilitates really well. And you don't get that when you're watching traditional linear broadcast or, you know, Six Nations on the BBC. So that for young people, that's almost a non-negotiable now, that more participatory relationship with media. And it's why they favor creators over a traditional live broadcast. If you know, even live games, if you lift them up and you plonk them on YouTube, they don't get quite the same engagement. But the other thing to say is YouTube is where people go to swim around in content. I mean, goodness me, you've got 110 million YouTube channels, billions of views of shorts and longer form content happening every single day. You can go there and no matter how strange your tastes, you'll find something that's interesting. So this is the interesting thing too, because as a sport fan, you will know as a sport fan, your fandom of a particular sport will be different to your friends. They might like a different, you know, a creator's tone of voice and you favor a separate one. They might like comedy lists of the, you know, top 10 hairstyles from the Prem 1992. You might like in-depth, deep dive, breakdowns of what happens in the pit lane in F1. It will always be there on YouTube. Someone will have uploaded it. That's what more traditional leagues really struggle with. I mean, that's a whole raft of content that they're not used to making.
Yeah.
Because as you said, when we were chatting just before we started recording, the media side of sport was something that you gave to someone else if you were a rights holder for a long time. You outsource that relationship with your audience, that creativity, all that stuff, like, you know, that people want to watch. And that was given to someone else. And now we're in this situation where even the broadcasters, it's not in their interest to do that too much. And the leagues don't have often the rights or the wherewithal to do it in terms of money. So who fills the vacuum? Well, creators fill the vacuum. pirate feeds fill the vacuum. So this is the interesting shift, I think, with YouTube. You're not going to beat it. So you might as well show up there and figure out how you are going to show up as a sport, a governing body, a league, a team, authentically, and start testing and learning. Yeah. That's the interesting thing. You could have a bit of fun. And YouTube is exactly the place to go and test and try something. Again, you get that feedback. You get that data. You iterate. If it doesn't work, if it does work, do more of it. That's exactly how creators like Sidemen and Mr. Beast have gotten to the size that they have.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, you know, I talked to Rob Pilgrim a few weeks ago, and one of the things that we kind of were batting around was this idea that YouTube couldn't have existed before. It is something different from TV, but it's still, like you say, it's recognizable as being that sort of behavior, particularly as it migrates to bigger screens.
Yeah.
But another platform that sort of replaced channel surfing or replaced sort of aimless TV watching in some ways is TikTok.
Of course.
Which is less of a kind of youth first platform than it was probably 5 years ago. But it is one that, in a way, it's like the first post-social media platform.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to think about what's that done to how people, and particularly young people, think about their media, and what does that mean for sport?
TikTok's such an interesting one. And bearing in mind, we're talking about YouTube and we're talking about TikTok in June 2025. You know, this time next year, we could be talking about a completely different relationship with sport and young people and their usage of those platforms, because that's the interesting thing. They're organic. They're changing. Them as platforms are changing. You know, who'd have said 5 years ago that we'd be talking about YouTube, the majority of YouTube consumption in the home happening through the big screen TV? It would have been unheard of. So, I mean, that's kind of why I get so excited about this thing, because it's a puzzle we're all trying to crack. And as soon as we've cracked it, then it changes and we need to go back to the drawing board. TikTok is an interesting one because, again, the majority of TikTok is consumed on mobile. So that's vertical video. That's a different consumption to watching on a widescreen. But again, tends to be much closer, much more intimate relationship you can have there. And by intimate, I mean it's like you and I chatting here. It's like you're having a natter with your friends on a walk or down the pub. And so TikTok is really great for creating that kind of personal connection. And I've seen that with players or with creators. I love Ilona Maher, who's the US rugby player, her TikTok and her Instagram reels. Brilliant. So there's an interesting connection that you can create there in sports as an athlete or a creator. Obviously, it doesn't really suit stadium type broadcast or larger scale stuff. So there's an opportunity there to start building a closer connection. That's the storytelling on TikTok. But it can be great for discovery because it's kind of that quick bites, isn't it? You know, remember Quibi? it's kind of that quick bite. It's when we're walking. It's when you're doing something else. It's while you're waiting for the tea to cook. You're scrolling TikTok. You're catching up on the day's news. You're just looking for something that's going to fill your brain for a few minutes. Or it's also great for discovery. Someone once likened TikTok to me as the old EPG, you know, the electronic program guide that used to come up on your TV and you would surf up and down it. And TikTok is a little bit like that, but TikTok is also symbiotic with YouTube. So there is a pattern, a well-established pattern that if you're scrolling and something gets your attention on TikTok, you'll go and see what else you can find on YouTube. Back to that swimming around in content on YouTube that I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
So it can be a lovely complementary. It can be a feeder into that wider media ecosystem. So that's why I think TikTok is really important in sport. But it's a very specific, back to need states again, it's a very specific need state when you're on TikTok. So you need to create a strategy for that.
Yeah. And another platform that, you know, comes up a lot in your work and in your world, but maybe sport doesn't think about as much or isn't as familiar with is something like Roblox or Minecraft to an extent as well. But, you know, those games that are kind of massively multiplayer online games, kids able to create in the world and experience events in the world and all that sort of stuff. You know, that convergence of entertainment and gaming happening in that way isn't, in some senses, it's not new, but it's never been as malleable as it is on those particular titles.
Yeah.
So what does that mean for the sort of multi-platform or multi-touch point or whatever you want to call it approach to storytelling?
Mm. I mean, I produced my first game on Roblox, where are we, 4.5 years ago. And even then, it felt to me like a platform that was pretty special. Now, that was with my old kids' media hat on. And at that time, people don't realize that Roblox is nearly as old as YouTube. It's 18 years old. So it's been around a while. It didn't just pop up in lockdown, like a lot of people assume. But even then, I started just getting that inkling that it was something special. I was kind of getting the same feelings as I got with YouTube kind of 2011, 2012. And because, again, it's a UGC platform and it's social, the two things that young people almost insist on having as part of their fandom and their media diet. So Roblox, often likened to the YouTube of gaming because there are millions of games and experiences on the platform. It's not one game, it's millions. And you can go on there and you can meet up with your friends. You can tell them which game you're in and they can come and join you. So again, social. You can obviously chat with them. There are age restrictions, but you know, we can park that. But you know, in theory, you can chat with them. You can all join together in one experience. And it's a very rewarding platform. So again, you can get stuff for your avatar. Loads of games will do drops. That drives a huge amount of traffic into the game. Those game loops where it's kind of that extrinsic reward. You do something, you level up, you get some coins, you improve. It's the gamification that we all loved as kids. It's just on a different platform. It's no different. So, but what that means is, again, you can start building communities there. They're spending 2.5 hours a day on average on the platform. That's US and UK kids. Slightly less across Europe, but it's a depth of engagement that sports as a business doesn't really realize. Gaming is still very often seen as something that's kind of a side activity.
Mm.
And it's something that mid-20-year-old guys do because they're playing Football Manager or EAFC. What they don't realize now is that social gaming is a whole different part of gaming. And actually, they're quite distinct and separate. That requires a different approach. Again, like we were just talking about, even right structures need changing if you're going to get onto Roblox. Because if you've given away football simulation rights in gaming and you've given it away to EA, then you can't do anything with football simulation on Roblox, even though the two audiences are very distinct. What Roblox is doing, again, evolving, is so it's got that frictionless consumption that young people like, infinite choice of games. You couldn't possibly play all of them. You've got community features. So it allows you to be social, collaborative, again, really important to young people. Now you can play video within a Roblox experience. So you can be in there engaging with your favorite sport and you can watch clips and you can even stream into Roblox. You can do live updates. So you could even get your sports breaking news or scores or goals in a game. That's interesting to me because that almost makes it a one-stop shop for young people's fandom, right? You don't need to go and check out Planet Football or whatever website you get your latest score updates from. You don't even have to go to YouTube to check out a highlights reel if it's streamed in Roblox. And then whilst you're there, you can play with your friends and you can buy a new kit drop. And it's even integrated with Shopify. So if there was a new kit drop, you could buy it for your avatar and off it goes into a Shopify basket and ultimately might turn up at your door. My goodness, doesn't that start to feel like a compelling proposition for the future of fandom? Now, it won't all happen at once, but that's where I see the direction of travel going with Roblox. Again, it's 18 years old. So there are users on the platform now that have been on that platform for 7, 8, 9, 10 years. They're getting to 17, 18, 19. The fastest growing cohort is that 17 to 24 segment on Roblox. So it's going to, again, another platform, another type of fandom that is burgeoning there that sports really needs to get ahead of.
Yeah, I mean, you talked a bit there about the right structure around simulation games and some of the other things that you might have parceled off in the gaming space. But strategically, how can those two fit together, or where's the trade-off? Where, if you were talking to a rights holder and you said, well, look, you can create a world like EA Sports FC where, you know, football fandom kind of lives in a lot of ways digitally, or you can create a world where you're inviting new fans in on Roblox. Where's the balance there, do you think?
There is a balance, because there's a very minimal kind of crossover. So one is not cannibalistic to the other. If anything, they can feed each other. Mm-hmm. They can become a bit of a flywheel. In terms of, I mean, you think about rights structures. And again, this is something that I went through a few years ago in kids media. When there are all these platforms that arise and your audience embrace them, so this multi-platform consumption, this multi-platform fandom that we're speaking about, on average, young people, if you ask them, if you do a straw poll to ask them to list out all of the platforms that they visit on a daily basis, you're into double figures pretty quickly. Now, if you are to try and engage a fan base across those, you've got to have a strategy for all those platforms. That's just what we've been talking about. So that then throws into relief how rights structures need to change. Because if you're a commercial director or you're in the licensing department of a league or a sports rights holder, the odds are now a lot of your rights structures don't really follow that fragmented media consumption. So now they need scrutinizing again in terms of, can you split out simulation rights in gaming? And could it feasibly, you get two deals, but one goes to one partner or supplier that works predominantly on one platform and another one goes to another. Those, for me, it's a way to better serve the fandom. I mean, if anything, you're doing two deals instead of one. There could be an opportunity there, but it serves the fans better because currently you're using a rights structure that doesn't fit how content is consumed. And it has held back some rights owners from being able to do what ideally they would have wanted to do on a certain platform because they don't have the rights or they sit with someone else. So, I mean, those things, it happens all the time. When there's a move forward in technology, you know, the rights structures take a while to follow. There's a lag.
Yeah.
It's kind of normal, but it will need addressing. Otherwise, we go back to that vacuum analogy again. If you can't articulate your sport, your league, your team, your club on there, there's a vacuum that someone else will fill. And then it's really hard to get their interest and attention back.
Sure. Who's doing this particularly well at the moment? Let's look outside the sports space, first of all. Who's a good kind of example to follow or to think about?
I mean, we mentioned BBC Studios, and that's because we've been speaking to them recently about Bluey. Again, you know, Bluey, brilliantly made. I'm sure you watch quite a bit of Bluey because I know you've got a young one. Yeah, brilliantly made. So that a real creator-led show, that one. Joe Brum, who created it. His DNA, his voice, all the way through Bluey. Very much creator-led, even though it was a TV show. But a multi-platform strategy from relatively early. So went on ABC in Australia, went on Disney, and then they started a YouTube strategy. And I mean, for the BBC, which is, again, traditionally not very forward-thinking in those matters, actually, they delivered a masterclass in creating that multi-platform strategy relatively early. Now, Bluey, less suited to Roblox because it's a preschool show. But interestingly, a lot of parents watch Bluey. I was shared an article from Hollywood Reporter earlier this week about lots of dads in the US watching sport, but also watching Bluey. Interesting there that there's a lot of sport fan dads that also love Bluey. So they have a great TikTok strategy for Bluey that talks to the parents. And again, one of the beautiful, charming things about Bluey is there are things in those stories that relate to parents that pull on the heartstrings or give you a wry smile. They're not written in that for kids, they're written for the grown-ups. And so they've played into that on TikTok and they've executed that brilliantly. So if you want an example of maybe how sports could look at someone that's done this and that is doing it well and not massive budgets, just done with intention, done strategically and done well, Bluey is a really, really good example of how they've nailed that multi-platform consumption.
Yeah, I mean, Bluey is a good show about parenthood as well. And I think it is definitely a show that families watch together. But it's also one that sport has kind of been woven in quite smartly, quite, you know, it's intrinsic to a lot of the stories. There's an episode that became quite celebrated about 18 months ago about cricket that works particularly well. But there are other ones as well that are about different aspects of fandom and stuff like that. Now, obviously, that's coming from the creator of that show, or the creative team behind that show. But there's also opportunities there on that storytelling side, right, to get a little bit involved in some of those some of those programs and some of those projects.
I mean, this is where I get very excited, Owen. You might regret asking me this question because this is you know, having been an animation producer, having been a gaming or a Roblox producer in a previous life, the opportunity for telling stories, really brilliantly engaging, fun stories in sport, is there. But to date, not really been activated, not really been utilized enough. Oh, and I'm just dying to kind of bring it into sport. You know, I was fortunate enough to meet the team behind Team J, which is Juventus's animated series that sits on YouTube. It's shown on Nick Jr. in Italy. They were forward-thinking enough to commission and create an animated series. They got quite a few episodes. It runs on YouTube. And it's a great, there's two things. Great storytelling. And some, you know, some kids will fall in love with it and then will decide that Juve is their team because they fall in love with the stories in Team J. But it can become a self-sustaining line of business in and of itself. You've got broadcast deals, you've got monetization on YouTube, and if it gets popular enough, you've got merch, you've got toys, you've got apparel, you've got all of that licensing revenue that you can then start bringing in. And particularly with animation and kids animation, you inherit a new audience every few years. Mm-hmm. So actually, you don't have to make a vast amount of it in order to keep it sustaining. So that is one of the best examples in sport that I've seen of someone embracing that more traditional kind of way of storytelling that was created by a rights owner and a team like Juve. I think you're right. I think Bluey weaves in sport because, you know, being a dad and a sport fan, again, came from the creator who was writing all those episodes, and you can see it comes through. But that's, you know, for me, there's a real opportunity to think about how you can tell some really interesting stories in and around sport with animation. Anime is having a huge moment, and anime really popular amongst teenagers globally, but particularly in the US, they cannot get enough anime. And I was speaking to an anime producer a few months ago who said, "Have you heard of Slam Dunk?" I was like, "No, I haven't heard of Slam Dunk." So off I went down a little rabbit hole. And Slam Dunk was a manga, an anime series about basketball. And it was huge during the 90s. I mean, it's actually credited with making basketball popular in Japan. And because, you know, anime, they tell really interesting stories. They have really relatable characters in anime. They're not afraid to lean into themes about competition, loss, grief, identity, all of that. They tell stories in a way that's really appealing to teenagers who are growing, you know, going through their own kind of stuff. And so what was really interesting is that I hadn't realized that there was this example from the 90s of an anime series and a manga series that actually had popularized basketball in a whole nation. And so, again, then it comes back to, well, that's the power of storytelling. There's something that we can hold up there and go, hey, look, this can be really influential. But alas, yeah, not having so much luck currently with trying to convince people in sports to maybe invest in animated content creation. But I'll keep banging the drum.
Yeah. What are, you know, we've talked about some of the structural difficulties that sport has to overcome in kind of pursuing this multi-platform storytelling approach. But what are some of the strengths that it has? What are some of the things that that it can lean into in order to kind of update the way that it reaches audiences?
I mean, the multi-platform storytelling, when you have infinite content choices and you've got a generation or two generations that live their lives across multiple platforms and their media diet is varied, how on earth are you going to cut through and be memorable? If you're only on one platform, that's it. You're just part of the wallpaper. So this idea that multi-platform storytelling, it gives you critical mass, that flywheel. Because if you can have your content on every platform where your audience is, and they're more likely to encounter it, then you're going to stick. So there's a visibility element to multi-platform storytelling. Again, it used to be that the value was in scarcity, exclusivity on one platform. That doesn't work anymore because attention is what's scarce now. That's what you have to trade in. So you've got to try and get attention across all of these platforms. And by the way, you're fighting for a share of interest and attention, you know, amongst, I even forget what the stat, about how many thousands of hours are uploaded to YouTube every single hour. I mean, you couldn't watch it all. So you've got to think about how you maintain that visibility and that relevance across all of those platforms. So if anything, I think it's necessary to have a multi-platform strategy. But that doesn't just mean you take something from one platform and you plonk it on another. And if you have to shorten it and clip it, then that's what you do. No. The audiences are much more sophisticated than that. Mm-hmm. So that's where, it's for visibility and relevance. But again, if you are looking to create fans, and let's bring in participation, because you know screen-based media is very often demonized because that equals inactivity, which means they're not playing sport, therefore must be bad. So if you are going to even increase participation, I think for me, you still need that multi-platform strategy because that whole ecosystem, if you're marching your audience around the ecosystem and participation is one of those pillars, then that is how you're going to do it. And again, there's been a really great example recently of the Royal and Ancient with their Just Swing game on Roblox. Did a really small test in Indonesia with Top Golf in Jakarta. Complete a golf challenge in Just Swing. You get a code for an hour's free golf at Top Golf Jakarta. And they had a couple of hundred young people between 8 and 14 went and redeemed this code at Top Golf. So doing something digitally in Roblox equals participation. The really interesting thing is 84% of those people who played went and redeemed their voucher for a free hour of golf went back. So they went back a second time. Top Golf are really chuffed because they're bringing their families, they're selling more food and beverage. The Royal and Ancient achieves their mission because one of their missions is obviously about increasing golf education and participation. And now we have a proof point for those people who go, no, screens gaming bad because it means you're not playing. You can go, right, well, we've got a proof point that actually that can work. I think that's really, really important.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's lots of things to unpack there and lots, I'm sure, for people across the sports industry and sports media to work on, but some really fascinating insights there. Three questions that we ask every guest to finish off with. Do you have an origin story or something that kind of kindled your interest in sport?
Well, as a gymnast when I was a girl, it was watching Nadia Comaneci at the Olympics and how amazing she was. So I used to train with the British champion and she'd competed in the Olympics with Nadia Comaneci. And so, she was kind of like my hero, I guess, kind of an equivalent of a Simone Biles to a lot of younger gymnasts these days. But again, I would rather watch sport than I'd watch a Netflix drama or, you know, that's what I love to do of an evening. My kind of sport origin story did start with gymnastics, but now it's just I'll watch anything. I'll watch darts, Crown Green bowling, cricket, coming from Yorkshire, having a dad that played cricket. I went to the Ashes in 1999 in Australia. You know, I'll watch anything.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
I think that's slam dunk. That's the thing that really sticks with me. If you've got a piece of sports storytelling, which is an animated, you know, it started off as a manga comic book and then became an animation, but it managed to increase the popularity of a sport in an entire country. That's pretty good storytelling. So that didn't come from the sport of basketball and was retrofit. Someone created that story, just really good characters, really good storytelling set within basketball, and managed to basically get a whole nation hooked on basketball. That's pretty powerful storytelling.
Yeah. And finally, you said, you know, you're eager to kind of switch people in sport onto the idea of using animated storytelling. But what's a particular story that you'd love to tell or see somebody else tell?
I mean, see, this is where I would be reliant on people in sport, because being relatively new to sport, I imagine there are hundreds of thousands of interesting stories that people that work in sport tell, and, you know, tell amongst themselves, you know, legendary stories that come up when they're, you know, sitting having meetings or at conferences. I'd love to delve into those and see how you could turn those into content. You know, I think there's probably lots. I'd love to create some animation that's based, that's aimed at that kind of 9 to 12, that real kind of, that's where fandom really starts to take root. And they're getting quite sophisticated in what they want to watch. It's certainly a way that they're beginning to self-identify. I like anime. I like comedy. I like this. I like that. But it's also a time where their fandom isn't widely cemented yet. So they're trying lots of different things. I think there's a real opportunity there for leagues and rights owners to create something that's really compelling, that could really hook young people in as a route into sports fandom.
Okay. Well, Joe, it's been a real pleasure. And I mean, there's bits there that could be podcasts on their own, but we've run out of time, unfortunately, for today. But thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me, Owen.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.